Yeah, I got that.
April 19th. Yeah,
this. Okay. Yeah. Oh, well. You know, I keep saying I'm going to get organized, so
why
thinking about
it. Okay, do we have sound? How do we get sound?
I'm old, that's the excuse. I'm old and I'm retired, I don't have
sound. Testing, no sound, testing.
1, 2, 3, 4.
We have no sound. How do we get sound?
Or last, there was one gap.
Testing. Ha! We have sound. We have liftoff. Good afternoon. So glad that you could come out on such an incredibly glorious April afternoon, typical April afternoon in the Northwest, right? Yeah, right. That is wonderful, and we're glad that you could be with us. So we'll call this meeting to order. The approval of the agenda.
Move to approve the agenda.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Approval of the minutes.
Move to approve the minutes.
Second.
Last meeting.
Richfield.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Okay.
Abstain.
I have no specific thing that I need to be reporting on today. Bob, do you as the vice chair?
Yeah, I do. I was pleased that Dr. Patrick Rendon at our last meeting began the presentation by stating that aging in place is more than an accessible living quarters. His position was the total community must be accessible and livable for aging in place to be fully achieved. Even though one's living quarters are accessible, not being able to go to the store, to the doctor, to appointments, to church, social events, due to lack of transportation means that aging in place is falling well short of expectations. Although the purpose of the commission is primarily aimed at the elderly, an accessible and living community benefits all ages. Hopefully we can address all the accessibility issues of aging in place in the home of the elderly as well as the community at large.
Thank you, Bob. Let me amend one thing. I should say that if you have not had the opportunity to do so, I would encourage you to read the book This Chair Rocks by Ashton Applewhite. It's a new book that deals with the whole subject of aging, and she does as well as anyone I have read recently. Exceedingly well done. We're all olders in process, and I love the concept. Communication report, Marjorie.
Yes, the communication committee, as we go along in housing installment number 4, January, February, March, as a support one. As we go, we are collecting highlights, not only of what the presentations are, but of the questions that the public asks. And those comments and questions can be made here at the meeting, or if you'd like, they can be emailed to us. What we hope to have at the end of this series is specific policy recommendations for consideration by our policymakers throughout Clark County. So we are pleased to always see you here and stay involved and tell us what you think.
Thank you. Treasurer's report, Chuck.
We are still staying at the same, we're at $884 and some change.
Okay. Karen, for our impact.
Our impact is the time bank program. It was rolled out in May of last year. I have been giving monthly reports on the program pretty much ever since then during our commission meetings. This will be probably the last monthly report that I will be giving you. Our impact, the time bank program, is now almost a year old, and we have over 100 members. I would encourage any of you who are interested to take a look at the program online. We have some information about it on our table just outside the door. We are going to have a birthday party for our impact on May 21st. We're going to be doing a cleanup at Klein-Line Park for a couple of hours, and then we will all enjoy birthday cake as a way of celebrating our 1 year anniversary. So once again, I won't be doing a monthly update anymore, but as a community, please look at the Our Impact Time Bank program. It's a wonderful program. It is free. We used to charge $25 for a background check. We're no longer doing that. We're doing the background checks, but we're not charging for them. So please take a look and join us. We'd love to have you, and join us for our party, May 21st, Klein-Line Park.
I'm just writing that down, free cake. Chuck, did you have anything with Universal Green Design?
Well, I think the only thing I'd like to bring up is that Amanda Davis is going to be our next speaker next month, and she comes to us from, she's the department head of the interior design at PCC. And you might go and ask yourself, well, what does interior design have to do with accessibility or universal design or anything like that? Well, it has an awful lot to go and do with it. And so she's gonna have a very fun session with us, and is going to be bringing in two of her students to kind of go through what they through what they do in the class. So I think it'll be a lot of fun. Be very, very informational, that's for sure, related around accessibility design and universal concept design. And so I would invite you all to come join us.
Okay, Allie, anything from the Public Health Advisory Council?
Nothing to report this morning.
All right, and we are gonna know anything we need to know about the Council for the Homeless very shortly. Let's move right to the main event for the day. I want to introduce Andy Silver, who is chairman for the Council for the Homeless here in town. I have known and worked with Andy and find him to be first a great friend, but an incredible person, collaborative person to work with. He is a huge treasure for our community, and has done a number of significant things since becoming chairman of Council for the Homeless here locally. And so he is addressing us on the challenges for affordable housing in an area of scarcity, and we all know what we all know about that. So Andy, you're on.
Thank you very much. Thank you to everybody for coming out on this lovely day. Hopefully you think you still made the right choice at the end of this presentation. If we could pull up the PowerPoint, yeah. So, as Bill said, my name is Andy Silver. I'm the Executive Director of the Council for the Homeless. And to begin today, I don't know if anybody recognizes this picture, but this is how I like to start out my talks. For those of you who don't remember this gentleman, Admiral Stockdale was Ross Perot's vice presidential running mate in 1992, and he famously went to a vice presidential debate and started his performance by saying, who am I and why am I here? So, who am I and why am I here? And why, you might be asking yourself, is somebody who works at the Council for the Homeless here to talk about affordable housing and affordable housing solutions. So what I want to do to start with is talk about sort of how the Council for the Homeless interacts with the issue of housing in our community and housing prices, and how we kind of came to see affordable housing as a crisis in our community and started to look at what could be done about it. So to understand that, I want to talk a little bit about what homeless services look like. People who aren't maybe very familiar with what homeless services look like in our community might think of emergency shelter when we talk about homeless services, or outreach workers going out on the streets and working with people in parks. And that's certainly all part of it. But what we've learned over the years is that the best response to homelessness is to quickly get people back into stable housing and give them the support that they need to make sure that they can stay there. About 3 years ago, we opened the Council for Homeless Housing Solutions Center, which is our community's one-stop access point to the different housing programs and emergency shelters in our community. And what we do there is people come in, it might be a family, it might be an individual, and we do an assessment to figure out what their needs are and who we can match them to in the community, all of our different partnering nonprofits that can meet those needs by getting them back into housing. So the heart of the work is providing, is finding that landlord in the community who's willing to take a shot with that family, and then providing them some rental assistance so they can afford the rent while you're working with them to get a better job or to tackle mental health challenges or whatever it is that that family or individual needs. So as we've been doing that work over the last couple of years in our community, we noticed a pretty drastic change. And what that change was is that the availability of housing in our community just started to go down. And what was out there in availability, the prices started to go up. And just as importantly, the screening criteria, so what property managers or landlords look for in picking their tenant, that those criteria became harder to meet, and that's a natural consequence of having a lot of people competing for less apartments. So I just want to share, there's some handouts that I think you all got that the City of Vancouver put together that are really great. And I just want to point out a couple statistics from those about what's going on in our local housing market. One statistic that's very important is what's called the rental vacancy rate, which is just a fancy way of saying how many apartments or houses, how many homes out there in the rental market are available to be rented at any given time. So obviously the higher that number is, the easier it is, the less competition it is for places, the less pressures on rent going up, the less demand, so the lower the screening criteria. And people debate what the actual number is. There are different ways to count. This is 1.87%. The takeaway here is that in our community, the vacancy rate is very low, and it's considerably lower than what's considered healthy, and it's considerably lower than the average in Washington State, which is lower than the average nationally. So that's when we look at what's driving rental increases, and we look at what's driving criteria like needing 3 times the rent in income or higher security deposits, we can go back to that vacancy rate. Another important statistic when we're looking at the people in our community on fixed income, or just the folks who are at the lower end of our income scales, they might be working, they might be on disability, they might be on Social Security. If you're looking at folks who make 50% of sort of the average income in the community below, half of those folks are paying over half their income in housing costs.
Wow.
Half of them are paying over half their income in housing costs. So let's just take a second to think about what that means. One thing it means is that everybody in that category is at risk of homelessness. Because one sort of setback, you know, maybe it's a medical bill, maybe the car breaks down, but one setback, they're just sort of on the edge right there. The other thing that means with a tight rental market is that pretty much everybody in that category, if they have to move for any reason, maybe they got a different job, maybe they need to be close to their kids, maybe the landlord wants to move into the house themselves and doesn't want to rent anymore, whatever the reason is, if you're paying over half your income in rent, and landlords and property management companies in our community are looking for 2.5 or 3 times the renting income, you can't move anywhere in our community, basically.
So, that was the...
Help.
Hello? Hello? Uh-oh. I upset somebody.
Wait, are we back?
Yes.
Okay. I'll be careful. So we started looking at this and the effect that we were seeing in the homelessness system, and we took a look and said, well, is this just us or what's going on here? And we saw this study out there which shows that with every $100 increase in rent in a community,
that's going to be really annoying.
Yeah. Really dicey.
I could just try to be really loud without the mic. I don't know if that's
no, true. They need it for TV. Just a minute. Here you have assistants. Allie, could you do a soft shoe? Just
yeah.
Or talk amongst yourselves. You could always grab Chuck's mic over there, Andy.
Yeah, really.
You could always grab that and just hold on to it for the time being. Where there's a will, there's a way. We'll do this deal.
Look at that.
I've been there too many times.
So the study found across the country, when we think of an individual who's homeless or a family that's homeless, we often think of, you know, what factors led that. You might think about losing a job or mental health or chemical dependency, and there's a long list that could go in there. But when you think on a community level, so you're not thinking about that individual family, when you're thinking on a community level, what drives the overall is homelessness increasing or decreasing, the biggest factor actually is housing costs. And the takeaway here is that housing costs drive demand for and success of homeless services. So what does that mean? The demand, so that group that's paying over half their income in rent, as the housing market, as the rents go up, there are more people at risk of homelessness. There are more people who might not be able to bridge that gap if they lose a job or if they have something happen. Sorry for stealing your mic. Thanks. And at the same time, the people who are doing this work in the community, all of our homeless service provider partners, it's hard to get somebody back into stable housing if we can't find an apartment that'll rent to them, if the rents are increasing so fast, they have to keep getting higher and higher paying jobs. All those factors come into play. So we learned that, you know, through the work that we're doing and said, all right, well, we got to figure out what's going on here. Let's take a look at what's causing this housing issue in our community so we can start talking about solutions. So these next couple slides, we're going to look on the national level over the last, in the relatively recent time frame, to look at some sort of big trends that are going on. And what you're looking at here is the increase in demand for rental housing. And the time frame that we're looking at this slide is about 2005 to 2015. And what we see is a huge increase in the demand for rental housing in that time frame. 9 million household increase, highest percentage since the mid-1960s. 37% of all households living in rental housing. So what's driving that? What happened from 2005 to 2015? There are two main things going on in this time frame. One is the demographics of our country are changing. So you've got the baby boomer generation aging. For folks who were here last month, we talked about aging in place. Well, part of what we talked about was where you live drives whether you can age in place. So what we're seeing is a lot of people moving from who might have owned homes that didn't have a bedroom on the first, a bathroom on the first floor, that weren't set up properly, and now they're moving into the rental market for a more appropriate setting for themselves. Then we've got the second biggest demographic category are our young folks, millennial age, and they're flooding the rental market as well. And what's the other dynamic that's happening with both of those is that in this time period we have the Great Recession and we have the housing bubble burst. So if you think back to that time frame, you think to what was going on in the news, we were all talking about the mortgages, right? And what was going on with the mortgages. And we were just handing out, you know, there was no income verification. And everybody was banking on the housing prices going up. And people weren't putting enough equity in their homes. And then we had the foreclosures. And so the response to the mortgage crisis was to go in the opposite direction. It's what you do, right? You respond to a crisis. So the legislation that came out of that really tightened up who could give what that mortgage industry looked like. And of course, the private market also responded. People lost a lot of money. And the banks on their own sort of tightened up what those requirements looked like. So all of a sudden, we're in a society where if you're a 27-year-old, even if you've got a good job, you're a college graduate, you're not buying your first home. You don't have 20% equity to put down. So you're in the rental market, your parents are now in the rental market, and we've got a big increase in demand. So how does that compare with the supply? And in this slide, we're looking specifically on the moderate and lower income end of things. Well, it's not that the number of low cost or moderate cost rentals went down. They did increase, but they didn't increase nearly as much as the demand increased. So if you look at that top one, the biggest disparity for low income households and low cost rentals, a 10% increase versus a 40% increase in demand. And that's not starting from zero, right? It's not like in 2003, we had enough low-cost rentals for everyone who needed it. There was already a big disparity there, and we just increased it greatly. So a question I get a lot is, okay, well, is it just a matter of supply and demand, right? We've moved a whole lot of people into the rental market, some by choice, some by other forces. The demand has gone up, the supply hasn't caught up. Can we just build our way out of it? Kind of. And that's what we're going to talk about now. So yes, but it's not just housing isn't one commodity. So this is I'm going to a danger zone, so I'm going to use a new analogy I've never used before, and I'll probably fail miserably. But let's think about fruit. So let's say there was not enough fruit. There was too low a supply of fruit, and fruit prices were going up. Could we get out of that by just producing 10 times more bananas, right? So if you want an apple, would it solve your problem if we just made more bananas, is the question. And it would have an effect. Like, if banana prices drop low enough, you might change your mind, right? You might say, I really want an apple, but I'm going to take this banana instead. Well, when we think about housing, we just think of housing as one type of thing. But housing isn't one type of thing. We've got all kinds of different types of housing, and different people at different demographic parts of their life, at different income levels, need different types of housing. So what we know for sure is if we just keep producing the mix of housing we're producing right now, if we just keep producing bananas, we're going to have a really inefficient solution, and there are going to be a lot of unhappy people who are sick of eating bananas. So this is more of a visual illustration of this, and what this is called the missing middle. And what you're seeing here is a range of what different types of housing in a community look like, or maybe more accurately, used to look like. So if you're in an older neighborhood, so maybe if you go walk around downtown Vancouver, for example, you might be in what we think of now as a single family home neighborhood. But as you walk around that neighborhood, you actually see quite a bit of diversity of housing. You might see a single family home that's 500, 600 square feet next to one that's three times as big. You might have a few duplexes or triplexes mixed in there. But if you go to the newer communities, you don't see that diversity in housing mix anymore. We've stopped building the middle of this range. And now we've started to basically just build, and this is an oversimplification, but sort of on average, we've really increased the building on the detached single family home side and on the larger, multifamily apartment building side, and all those sorts of things in the middle have fallen out. And especially as we're talking about our aging population, aging in place, a lot of those middle housing options are the ones that are going to be attractive to folks who want to live at home, but might want more of a sense of community, might want more of shared activities within that living arrangement. So why is that happening, right? And this is the part of my talk where you look outside and you think, seriously, it's 85 degrees outside, this guy's going to talk about multifamily zoning. But this is really important, because it's not the market, it's not the private market that's driving the fact that we're just building on either end of that spectrum. It's all of the different rules that we've organized ourselves as a community, in our cities, in our towns, in our county. So it's the how we zone things. It's how we've set the cost structures of what the developers have to pay to the jurisdiction and the rules that they have to play by. It's our financial institutions who are also setting their own rules around what the housing needs to look like and how people need to maximize the profit and the best use of the land that's driving us building on the two ends of the spectrum. And I'm just going to give a couple quick examples of what this means. So many of our local jurisdictions have a requirement if you're building a planned development, right? You're going to build a new neighborhood. They want a minimum amount of what's called frontage on all of the lots, right? So they want each one to have a certain amount of on the road and a certain size and all of that. And many of our local jurisdictions won't let you average that across all of your lots. You have to do it for every single one. Well, that drives what you can put there, first of all, because you can't do some of our more creative housing arrangements. It also drives the cost of what that housing is going to be at the end. Because if you have to build a certain size home and you have to pay for that certain size lot, that's going to drive up the price. So it prevents the market from responding and saying, well, what we'll do is we'll make a few bigger homes, and we'll make a few smaller homes, and we'll make a diversity. That option's off the table. So that's just one small example of how these decisions play out. So what we need to do is we need to tackle this on three different levels. So we need the policy and regulatory framework, and we're going to talk a little bit more about what that could look like. We need the financing environment, which is going to be our private partners in the banking industry, but also as we talk about that full range of housing options and our folks who are working in our service industry and or who are on fixed income or disability, we're also going to need to talk about public investment as well, because there just isn't any way to get the full housing spectrum in the private market. So on that policy regulatory environment, there's lots of different options here for local jurisdictions to play with if they're willing. And a great example, the city of Vancouver had an entire affordable housing task force that got put together, and they have a whole report that's come out with a list of different options that the city is now looking at. And for those of you who are really sort of interested in the details on this, I would recommend taking a look at that. But to sum it up, they fall into a couple different categories. One is a big category called system development costs. And that's the way that a jurisdiction will say, well, you can build this housing here, but that housing, right, is going to cause a lot of different costs to the community in general. So by paying your system development costs, you've paid in and you've taken care of that, so that, you know, we're not just passing that on to the taxpayer. That's a fine idea, but how you charge those system development costs can go a long way into how the market is responding to the need. So if your system development costs, to put it another way, make it so that the highest profit margin is by building the biggest multifamily high-rise, then developers are going to build the biggest multifamily high-rise. If your system development costs are structured in a way that support more of that middle of the range, the market will respond. The market's always going to go for the biggest profit. It's a matter of setting up the rules of where that profit lies. And there have been lots of different sort of just easy ways to start tackling this that I've discussed, like just having pre-approved plans for certain types of housing. So let's say there was a great model, one of those missing middles, where people who were aging and looking for sort of a setup where maybe there were houses around a courtyard that was shared, and maybe there's you could have a shared sort of community center and with a kitchen and activities that could come in. You could have a pre-approved plan by the local jurisdiction that said, if you want to build something like that, here are two options that we've already okayed. And if you pick one of those options, you skip to the end of the line for planning and all of that, and you can save yourself money. Financing. Financing is a huge part of this, and there are multiple pieces to it. We're not going to go into a crazy amount of detail here, but one of the things that is important to know is that the traditional funding streams for affordable housing, so the federal government provides some funding to create affordable housing in communities, that funding has gone down quite a bit over the years. The federal government has really disinvested from affordable housing. And at the same time, the strings attached, the rules of what you can do with that affordable housing drives up the cost of the developments if you take that money, which means the money doesn't go as far. There's less of it, and it's more expensive to build. So one of the things that we have to do is look at locally controlled sources of funding if we're going to really build the mix of housing to support a healthy community. The city of Vancouver is sort of taking the lead on that conversation. The city council is looking at an affordable housing levy where there would be a vote in November saying, you know, if you're willing to pay another quarter a day in property taxes, that could raise $40 million to invest, that nonprofits and others could invest and build and preserve affordable housing for seniors and veterans and homeless school kids in our community. The good thing about having locally controlled funds like that are that, one, you control, being the city in this case, would control what strings are attached, so you wouldn't have to drive up that cost as much as the federal government does. And the other thing is that you can leverage private dollars. So other communities that have done this have seen 5-to-1 leveraging of other dollars, where you raise $40 million, you can then leverage $200 million in other investments. So all of a sudden, for that small investment from the community, you've got $200+ million building affordable housing. And then the last piece is that if we have the right environment and we have the money and the public-private partnerships to do it, we still need somebody to step up and say, this is my mission. This is what I want to do in the community. And it doesn't have to be, it can be a nonprofit, it can be a housing authority, it can be a for-profit. I want to talk a little bit about social entrepreneurship here as I wrap up. But what we need is we need to build our local capacity of people who say, I see the need in the community, right? I see the need around our aging population, I see the need around what's happening in our schools around homelessness, and our kids not being able to learn, and I'm going to make a career out of this. And that doesn't mean I can't make any money, right? This is a totally made-up slide, so don't pay attention to numbers. But this illustrates what I mean by social entrepreneurship. You can make money and do the right thing. You might not be able to make quite as much money, but you can still make money. So one thing that sort of is out there right now is that people start to say that the social justice degree of the 21st century is the MBA, is a business degree. And when they say that, what they mean is we're going to need people, we're going to need entrepreneurs in our community who say, you know, we have to support folks who are getting older in our community and aging in place. And there are going to be a whole bunch of different types of businesses that come about to support that. We're going to need to develop housing that supports people who need a second chance in our community. And that's going to be a different business model than just straight building large apartment buildings, but you can still make money doing it, and you can do something good for the community as a whole. So my ask of you all is to spread the word around this concept of social entrepreneurship as we work with our local governments to make that policy and regulatory environment, and we work to get the funding in place. We want a whole community of people who are raring to go to use these tools to help us to get to a community where the people who work here and make the incomes that our jobs pay can afford to live here too. So I'm going to wrap up there and see if folks have any questions.
Questions? Back here. Let's do. Can we? Well, just a minute. Let us bring a mic over so everybody can hear you.
While we're waiting for the mic to get there, Andy, I really appreciated you highlighting what difference policy can make, because that's what we're interested in. And I really like what you highlighted about the system costs and how that can be influenced by zoning and so forth. So thank you for that.
Your comment about sort of the three-legged stool and working with regulatory, financial, and the policymakers, but I'm kind of curious, like for a gathering tonight, how many of us are policymakers? How many of us are regulators? How many of us are in the financial community that could help with this? So I imagine that you also could be making presentations like this and probably already have been asked to with those sectors. Are there other people in similar positions to you who are doing the same thing, or how can we get more people?
Right. So I actually answer your question by saying you might not know it or not, but you all are policymakers. And what I mean by that is that hopefully you're all registered to vote somewhere, wherever you live. And this doesn't happen in a bubble, right? I mean, you elect the people you elect, and they listen to the folks that talk to them about these issues. And unfortunately, this didn't happen. What I described with some of the zoning, some of that didn't happen by mistake. That happened intentionally. And it happened because people in our community, in our neighborhoods, said, I don't want anything other than a certain size house to be here. They might have not said that out loud. They might not have testified at a council meeting. But that's why that exists. And as I think you know, those decisions got made over time, and they got made before a lot of these sort of community changes happened. And part of what I'm trying to do tonight, what I would encourage others to do, is educate our community about the consequences of those decisions. And if you're concerned about homelessness, if you're concerned about rental prices going up, if you're concerned about education or health systems, law enforcement, this is a really important issue. And at some point, our community is going to have to ask themselves, what's more important? Not having a diversity of housing in my community, or sending my kid to a school where 1,000 of the students that they're going to school with are homeless. So you are a policymaker, and I'm encouraging you all to sort of help spread the word about how our elected officials can help solve this problem.
Andy, comment, question. We all hope as citizens that, regardless of what the issue, you know, when the rubber hits the road, we will all do the right thing. But I'm wondering, do you have any ideas on how you can or we can incentivize in an area of competing needs, incentivize a government to make building of low-cost units a little cheaper, and how, as individuals, somehow maybe you can incentivize through tax credits or whatever to help that along. If you could do anything you wanted, wave a magic wand, what would you do to help the affordable housing crisis?
So is it, well, on the cost side of housing, so if you picture that, the missing middle slide with the different types of housing, we could have a similar slide of sort of the different needs around the cost of housing, right? You've got, just think of all the different jobs in our community, and you can start to picture, you know, what we need to do in terms of getting to where we can go. Incentives in particular work really well on the middle to the sort of the beginning of the lower cost end of that cost. So if you're if you make $40,000 a year at your job and you have a family of three, you know, there are ways that we can lower the cost for builders perhaps to meet the needs there. You can, communities have waived system development costs for affordable housing. They've looked at zoning incentives, like if you're building multifamily housing in a commercial area, you have to put commercial on the first floor, which can drive up the cost of development. If you, places have said, you don't have to do that if you'll put a certain number of affordable units in your apartment building. So there are different things like that you can do to sort of start getting at, you know, knocking off $100 or $200 in rent a month for an apartment. As you move further down that income scale and you say, well, if somebody's on Social Security income in our community, they make $700 and change a month, how do we make sure they're in stable housing? That's where you need to sort of go from incentives to actually subsidizing the cost of the housing.
Thank you very much.
Question right back here.
I have a question. I am interested in converting part of our oversized garage into a one-bedroom apartment that's wheelchair accessible, that's totally accessible, which, by the way, I really like this little document here. The screen building is also accessible building because it has, it kind of combines the two of them. It's really great to see that. But I was wondering about, as much what the person just before me asked about incentives, if there's any incentives and how to afford to do that, or if there's, I know permitting can be very expensive. I am disabled, my son is disabled, my husband is old. And I just see in the near future, or distant future, who knows, a situation where it would be really beneficial to have a separate one-bedroom apartment that could be used for like a certified nursing assistant if we need it, or could be used for, you know, my disabled son to live there if he is unable to find gainful employment. And I just am very interested in doing that in my home, and I would make it a totally accessible unit as well, because I don't think there's enough of those out there.
Absolutely. Yeah, actually, as we see with the accessibility part of that question, the older the housing stock is, the more likely it is to be on the lower rent end of the spectrum, and the least likely it is to be accessible. So when we're talking about affordable housing, that's a huge issue, is how do we make sure that the housing in our community is accessible. The rules around, mother-in-law suites, AUDs, that whole idea of building sort of an extra unit on your property, those rules are governed by the jurisdiction that you live in. So, you know, City of Vancouver, City of Richfield, unincorporated Clark County. And right now, depending on where you live, the rules are a bit different. And one thing that is a topic that's come up in the City of Vancouver, and they're looking for ways, you can do it right now with certain rules, they're looking for ways to make it cost less and be easier. And one thing that I think that I'd like to work on, and others in the community would like to work on, is how do we start getting some of those rules to be consistent throughout our region? So whether it's that topic or other types of housing, there are some set ways that people can You know, there's some set plans people can go to, some set rules people can do it by, no matter which part of our county they live in. So I can't answer your specific question about where you live necessarily, but the last thing I would say on that, so check with the jurisdiction you live in. The last thing I would say about that is that one of the uses of a local fund for housing, whether that's the one the city's working on, or Vancouver or others, is that that money can be used to create new affordable housing or preserve. So if you're a homeowner looking to rent a home that you own and you want to keep it affordable, that money could be used to, you know, fix up the rent, give you money to fix up the rent, but rather than having to then increase your rent and kick the person out who's lived there, it might be able to help you fix the rent, the roof, and then keep the rent low and keep renting the person.
Another thing to say on that is that we have talked about that as a commission, that ADUs are also helpful for people as they age for another income stream that is very necessary in this day and age, or also kind of a symbiotic relationship. Somebody for a lower rent could help with yard work or whatever to enable somebody to stay in their home, which could be very beneficial for both sides of the equation.
Will there be a set? Is there any possibility that there is any incentives to, like, for people who would be needing to get permits and everything? I know that can add up to a lot of money. I guess that was the question: is if you're looking at incentivizing, making it easier for people who would like to make some sort of a dwelling unit like that, right, make it more possible, more affordable.
Right. Yeah. So one of the proposals in the City of Vancouver Task Force is to sort of come up with some standard ADU plans and models, so that if you want to pick one of those, you would have less cost and a quicker process.
So,
exactly.
Great.
And what Andy's talking about is there's kind of a disparity in some of the places you can do things in the City of Vancouver that you cannot do in unincorporated Clark County, for instance. You can't have a stove in unincorporated Clark County, even though you have everything else. And you can have one in City Vancouver. It really makes no sense. So it's the kind of thing where they're hopefully getting those things together, working on them as we speak. There was a question over here.
Now I have a question too.
While I'm waiting for the microphone.
Oh.
Real quick, Andy, you said this was a national problem, or it appears to be that. Do you have examples from any other cities who have used the controlled funds, or taking control of a fund to develop?
Yeah, so Bellingham, for example, here in Washington in 2012, passed an affordable housing levy, and they've that's actually where the statistic about the 5-to-1 leveraging the funds comes from. So they've been able to do quite a bit of building that's in the pipeline around affordable housing. There are lots of jurisdictions that have housing trust funds or other local funds that go to build it, and also different types of zoning setups like inclusionary zoning that kind of give the master plan for the community as well of how to get the affordable housing dispersed throughout the community.
And do you know if those examples have reduced the homelessness rates in those cities, like in Bellingham, or using those systems in place?
I don't know off the top of my head in Bellingham if their homelessness numbers are going up or down. What I would say is that we know that the homelessness rates are tied to housing costs. So if the community is able to, we talk about it in the health world, bending the cost curve. If we're able to bend the cost curve in a rental market, we'll see the results in our homelessness numbers.
A question over here.
Hi, Andy. I'm Andy. Nice to meet you too. I've got a question about strengths on the, of course, federal funds. Okay, you're in now.
Yeah.
Okay, nice. Anyway, so a lot of strengths. I know there's a lot of strengths on this federal funding. The levy, less strengths. Can you give me some examples of what strengths may be brought for the
Sure. So an example would be, and then this will ultimately be up to the jurisdiction that has the funds, so the City of Vancouver, it'd be up to the City of Vancouver. But an example might be, one of the things that drives up the cost of construction is the time horizon that the builder is expecting to own the property, and basically how long they're looking to own the property without having to refinance. So with affordable housing, often you're working on 40-year time horizons. So you're building with the idea that you need to make it pencil out for that whole 40-year plus period. Whereas in the private market, you might be looking at sort of more like a 7-year cycle, where whether you continue to own it, but you're going to refinance it and use that money to rehab, or you're going to flip it in 7 years, it's just different way to do the building. And that can have a significant impact on the cost. There are also lots of, for like low income tax credits, there are lots of different studies you have to do, and environmental impact, and things that are much above and beyond what we require sort of generally in the community. And those things, each one of those adds up to the cost as well.
So kind of a follow-up question then, if we're using the levy funds to leverage federal funds, doesn't that kind of bring some of the strength back in?
Yeah, if you use the levy dollars to leverage like low-income tax credit deals, it would. If you use the levy dollars to leverage private financing, then it wouldn't. So that would be part of what, so how this would work from a functional perspective is if the city or a different entity had that funding, there'd be a competitive application process to get those dollars. So people would come in and say, this is what I'm trying to build, this is how much it costs, these are the other funding sources I'm going after. And the people who sit on that community advisory panel would then look at that and try to get the best mix for the community. So you wouldn't want to exclude low-income tax credit, because that is a great way to build affordable housing. It's just a limited strategy, because our communities only get so many of those a year. So you want to still have those projects, but you mix in some of the more diversity in the housing types as well.
There's another question, right?
How do you find it works for nonprofits using tax credits in this community? Is there a lot of use of it? And are the strings, you kind of imply maybe that would pull in too many strings and regulations, but I just wonder what your experience.
So I don't mean to say that tax credits are not a good way to produce affordable housing. And I want to make sure I make that clear. We should still use tax credits as much as we can. It's just not going to be, we can't take that to scale. There aren't enough. So there are two different ways to do tax credits. There's the 9% and the 4%. You don't need to know the details other than the 4% is, we can do more of those, but the housing is less affordable. So that's really working with people who are at the higher income end of affordable. The 9% are much more competitive to get, but allow you to do things like Lincoln Place, which is the building that serves people who are chronically homeless. Mm-hmm. The issue is that there just aren't a lot of those. It's very competitive, and you know, we might get one or two a year at best, and you know, that's not going to be enough building to get us out of this. So it's how do we do that and add to it?
There's a question back there.
So maybe you can help clarify something that I read in the paper and I'm really not understanding well. And if I don't have any of my information correct, just interrupt.
Okay.
So I've seen a couple things in the paper about the tax abatements that developers can get of 8 years or 12 years. And I don't know why the two numbers, but it said that they would have to have 20% of their units income restricted, but the restriction was that they can make no more than 115% of the median income here, which they was 59,000 and something for a single person. I've got a number of single tenants, and I bet you none of them are coming even close to that income. And I'm wondering, did I understand that correctly? And if so, what's the point of giving those developers tax breaks to give to have a top income limit that's in the range of what almost anybody could go out and get a one-person apartment for on the open market?
Right. Great question. So the question is about what's called a multifamily tax abatement program. It is a statewide program that local jurisdictions can use. And it gives developers 8 or 12 year tax breaks, basically, in exchange for keeping some of their units in that building at a certain income range. As Carol Lee brought up, the top of that range and the jurisdiction can control this is 115% of what's called area median income. So it goes very, very high. What the Affordable Housing Task Force recommended to the city of Vancouver and what they're looking at or maybe are even in the process of changing is lowering those income thresholds. So to use it as a tool, as one of those incentive tools, how to incentivize more affordable housing development, but lowering the getting a better bang for your buck, so making sure that the apartments are more affordable. Basically, the reason it's like that, from my understanding, is that it was the current version of the program was created at a time. It's targeted to downtown and one other area right now in Vancouver, and it was created at a time where it wasn't really supposed to be an affordable housing development tool. They were really just looking at attracting housing, period, to the downtown. Obviously, our situations have changed greatly since then, and now it's time to update that and really make sure it's an affordable housing tool.
I have one kind of follow-up question, and I know there are several hundred apartments in the downtown area either under construction or in the development process. Has anybody given a guesstimate of what that might do to the vacancy rates? I mean, it's probably would be reading your crystal ball, but maybe you've got some thoughts that I don't have.
It's a good question. Yeah, it's a sophisticated, it's tough to do that evaluation because it's easy to say, well, how many apartments represent, a percentage point of that vacancy rate? But we have a lot of pent-up demand, and that's the thing that works it the other way. So there are two factors that are happening when more apartments come on the market. We've got folks who are, so take our millennials, for example. We have folks who are still living with their parents who would like not to be, who are going to move out into some of those apartments, but not necessarily freeing up another apartment. And then, of course, because we're part of the Portland metro area, and this is also happening on the other side of the river, we're seeing an influx of people being displaced from Portland who are looking for rental units. So I honestly don't have a good, I don't have a sophisticated way to analyze all of those factors together, but what we're looking at is we're expecting, even with the increase in supply coming on the market, we're expecting this issue to stay in our community for a while because of that side factor.
You talked about the social entrepreneurship. Can you give us some examples of different projects here in Clark County, or a project in Clark County that has used that format successfully?
I'm not sure I could give you an example here in Clark County, but I will give you an example outside of Clark County. So one sort of creative way to do this is something called social impact bonds or social impact financing, where another term for it is pay for success, where you get sort of private investors who put up dollars to do a social intervention with the expectation that social intervention will save the government or some other entity money, and there's an agreement in place that if you hit those benchmarks, the money gets paid back to the investor. So that's been done in some places around supportive housing, for example. So housing for populations who have lots of needs and end up, if they're not in stable housing, costing law enforcement, hospitals, other systems money. And for example, in Massachusetts, Goldman Sachs invested $10 million in providing supportive housing solutions, and the government agreed basically to pay that money back if it works with a return. So that's sort of one creative way to get into the social entrepreneurship area. The Council for the Homeless, we've sort of started this work a little bit locally by creating an LLC called the Housing Initiative, where we're looking at both providing technical assistance to people who are interested in doing this type of work locally, and also looking for opportunities to partner to do some mission-driven property ownership, financing, that sort of thing.
Your question in the back?
Oh, yeah.
My name is Mary Brown. I have a situation with homelessness involves if I cross the river, I'd probably be dead by my neighbor, so I can't go there. I was born there. But Monday morning I woke up and there were like six fire trucks, and I was shocked. I heard a knock on the door. The people next door are an Asian family. Apparently the gentleman, when the fire broke out, was running around knocking on people's doors to try and get somebody to call. He's okay, but my concern is because a lot of concerns. I've been to meetings where there are ladies that are older than I am. I'm a senior, but they have said they're in 30 years they've been living in the same place. They went on like $349, 1 month rent. That's a crime. It's not like you can have kids. I met another lady who talked that. Been a public servant and worked most of her life. Hers went up $400. I've been offered an apartment, or at least applied. The only apartment I could afford on an $847 disability account was $749. And I didn't answer them, and I don't know if I should, because I'm still very close to getting a job, I think, I pray. But waking up and seeing people's belongings piled up on the thing, all of these gentlemen, firemen, getting unpeeled of all that stuff. There's a lot of trauma in our society, and people who are homeless, they need things to be able to do. They are still human beings. They need to be part of the solution. If they were just given a teeny place where they could get some peace to sleep, teeny little cubicles where they can go and actually sleep and get some rest instead of walking around all night.
I think we understand your question. Andy, do you want to react to that?
Oh, could I finish just a little bit? But and I'm also concerned. I've been told that by a lady of color that in the Orchards neighborhood, I'm living in a shared house. I've been told that my posterior gluteus maximus was too big for this neighborhood, and that I needed to fix my teeth, and that I was temporary. This lady yelled this in public. I'm concerned about racial stuff. If a community does not want a mixed racial thing, because we're in an international, with the internet, we are an international community in this room. I am my brother's keeper, and if we can't have compassion over people and try to give them some way to produce, to put something into the community, we're just doing population control, we're just killing people. And I went to a SALT meeting where a lady was suggesting that people downsize, and I talked to a 90-year-old little white-haired lady who told me this is, and what she's saying is from memories. When you get older, you have to cling to the joy of your life. You don't have that much activity. You can't go around doing things, but I have some very deep concerns. But I had ladies who were white-haired, who maybe were 20 years old, bend over, pick up coins for me just out of compassion because I've got bad arthritis.
Right.
I'm saying a lot of stuff, but the homeless it's written in scripture. The poor are always with us. We're gonna have to face that and stop looking at it. Homeless people are still human and they have something. They, if they were given some way to contribute to society, so whether it's a block where they can pick up litter. I pick up litter all the time.
Yeah.
It's a joy for me. Anyway, it's just...
Well, I think what you've made a good point of the humanity of the situation, and I think what gets lost in the discussion of statistics and zoning and housing prices is what is that human toll if we don't act and just let things keep going. And you know, I think of my where I live, it's sort of the center for my family. You know, it's where if I've had a tough day, it's where I go to unwind. It's where we try to eat dinner together. It's where memories are made. And if you don't have that, if you don't have that growing up, if you don't have that as you get older, if you don't have that place in your life, it just makes everything else unravel. And that's why we need to tackle this issue, and we need to do it across the board. We need to do it by you know, things like day centers and volunteering, but we also need to do it by policy and by investing as a community in solutions.
Thank you so much, Andy. That's all the time we have for questions today. We need to move on to the other part of our meeting. So thank you so much.
Okay, our chairman has left. Are you going to take over, or do you want me to take over?
Well, I think our comp plan update is next. Is that
yeah.
right, Jackie?
Jackie, you got it? Go ahead.
Okay. I'll make this quick. Throughout the last couple of years, I've periodically updated the commission on the Clark County Comprehensive Growth Plan update. As you recall, many of the efforts and work that went into the Aging Readiness Plan and the task force and communication with the community, there were some things that were to move forward to the comp plan. And I just wanted to, and we sent out a link recently, and I think everyone that was on our mailing list also received it. It was a news release for a community engagement tool that we're using for the public to comment on policies. And I just wanted to bring it to, you know, say today that, you know, a couple of the policies come from the Aging Readiness Plan, and those are in the community design element and the housing element. And if you go to the county's website, you can go under services, and the tool is called Engage Clark County, or you can probably just Google it and reach it that way. And there are several elements of the policy documents that the public can comment on. And I think it's going to be a useful tool for people to be able to dialogue on those new proposed policies. So I'm here.
Could you send us that link again so that we can give it some more time and thought while we're in our own computers and make sure we have our say? What the work of the Commission on Aging does not matter unless it turns into policy. So we all want to do our part on that. Thank you. I think.
Okay. I want to thank Andy not only for his presentation today, but for the work he's doing in the community. Not only with the homeless, but working on with the city of Vancouver. And Bill is also on that group that's trying to deal with the homeless and the housing situation. But I would like to say that one of the stumbling blocks that we have in the homeless area is not necessarily housing. It's mental health and criminal justice. And the community gets excited about not in my backyard. And really what we're not maybe dealing with as well as we should is mental health and criminal justice things. Because those are the folks that probably need as much help as those who don't have housing. Okay, any more comments from the
Did we want an update or have a motion in reference to what we were discussing on time banking?
Okay, go right ahead.
Do we need a motion to move that program into the auspices of the county?
I think we do. Are you ready?
Yeah, what if we make it?
Okay, I move that we move time banking under the auspices of the county. We as the creators of that program.
Okay, do we have a second?
I'll second.
All in favor?
All in favor say aye.
Aye.
So moved. Okay, our next speaker in May 3rd at 5:30 will be Amanda Davis, and as you so aptly put, what she's going to be talking about is not necessarily drapes and painting, but she's going to be talking about how should a house be organized in order to be accessible. So it should be a good program. I hope everyone has an opportunity to attend that one.
And then we want to remind everybody here to be at County Council on May 3rd for the Declaration for Older Americans Month.
And birthday party, May 21st at Klein Line Park.
Okay, we got Hank.
Bob, I just had a quick question. I think, according to this flyer, Amanda Davis is on May 17th. I thought I heard you say May 3rd. Maybe I'm wrong.
May 3rd is the special session with the county commissioner, county councilors
May 17th.
Proclamation on Older Americans Month.
Yeah. Okay, thank you.
But our next meeting is on the 17th of May. Okay, any further comment? You got a question?
Yeah, I got one question.
Okay.
I don't want to take a long time. I had a list of 15 things to talk about. And it's so good for my own business. It does good work. However, as far as your committee is concerned, when you look at a problem, look at the cause. What is the cause of all this stuff? I've been on a long time. I wasn't even Mike Pike. That's okay. Mike and Silva does a good job. When you guys look at the problems out there, there's a cause for these problems. Some of it is on the committee itself. And look at yourself in the mirror, too. Because there are solutions out there. There are solutions. There was nothing broke in this housing problem. It's broke now. It shouldn't be. It never should have been broke. I've been here for 10 years. I know I've built affordable housing. I haven't been built.
Well, at this point, I think we're all working on that project, and we thank you for bringing it up again. We're not going to miss that one.
Mr. Chair, we adjourn.
Okay, we got a motion to adjourn. Second. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
There you go.
I want to introduce myself.
Oh.